Is it possible we are already entering another dark age? Is that what nature needs to recover? Next in my series of experts on the coming collapse, we enter the long view world of Professor Sing C. Chu. Dr. Chu is a global teacher. He's a professor of sociology at Humboldt State University in California. He's a senior research scientist at Helmholtz Center for Environmental Research in Leipzig, Germany. Dr. Chu has been a visiting professor at universities in Singapore, Hong Kong, Sweden, and Hawaii. As you might imagine, Sing C. Chu is the author of many papers and books. We'll be drawing from just his trilogy on how civilizations rise and fall with their degradation of nature. They are Volume 1, World Ecological Degradation, Accumulation, Urbanization, and Deforestation, 3000 BC to AD 2000. Volume 2, The Recurring Dark Ages, Ecological Stress, Climate Changes, and System Transformation. And Volume 3 in 2008, Ecological Futures, What History Can Teach Us. Yes, Dr. Chu tells us the coming dark age is an inevitable cycle of civilization consuming the natural world. That may not be a tragedy. It may mean a rest for the natural world and eventually a rebirth for the human story. I'm Alex Smith, Dr. Sing Chu. A warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Your body of work is so overwhelming, I hesitate to try and compress it into a mere interview, but let's see what we can do together.
Yeah.
You began with your doctorate work on forestry and the impact of deforestation, I believe. Does that continue to play a role in our current situation?
Yes, as you can tell, deforestation has been going on for at least 5,000 years since the start of human civilization. And therefore, it's very important to be aware of that. And also for me, the deforest is more like a canary in the coal mine. If the canary passes out in the coal mine, then we have danger. And therefore, the forest, if there have been continuous deforestation, we will also have severe problems, especially when the forest is a carbon sequestration element in the whole reproduction of the whole natural processes.
Now, one thing I found interesting in your writing is that in our prehistory, the challenge was more about global cooling as the ice sheets moved south. And now we're looking at a warming trend, but you say there isn't a great deal of difference as far as our development goes.
Yeah, I try to discuss that mainly, I believe, it's in Volume 2 of the trilogy, and especially also in Volume 3. And what is really interesting that's going on now is that people are all commenting on climate forcing and the increase in terms of upcoming increase, I would say, of the climate in terms of temperature increases and disturbances. But if you look at the whole history of the climate of the planet, it has been quite chaotic until around, well, I would say, 6,000 years ago before the appearance of the Holocene period. And here the work of, in my book, I refer to the work of Willem Ruderman, where he argues that since the dawn of human civilization, whereby we have the advent of agriculture, especially in the Fertile Crescent, which is now modern southern Iraq, and also in the Huangho Valley, which is now accepted as one of the earliest civilizations that started. And what that caused is that it started the increase in terms of carbon dioxide and methane. And so on that basis, there's already climate forcing in the early periods of human history. But prior to the 6,000 years, or I would say 8 to 6,000 years ago, the climate has been very chaotic. And it's only during the arrival of the Holocene period whereby there was a climate modulation, and that's the type of weather that we see these days in the sense of chaotic changes. And so the argument is that the humans have, in a sense, like we all have agreed, other than climate deniers, that there has been a real dramatic increase in temperature, and especially within the last 200 years, where you're very familiar with the hockey stick effect, whereby human forcing has been quite dramatic as a consequence of a series of industrial revolutions. So what we are seeing now is a really chaotic period. or upcoming as well. But there had been chaotic periods, but that's before, that's around 6,000 to 8,000 years ago.
Right, before the time of civilization as we know it now. Now, let's move forward a bit. You've really looked at the Dark Ages, and in fact, one of your books is really about that. And there were three previous Dark Ages. Can you tell us about those and why they are really more important in history than we've given them credit?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I, when I was starting to do the research for the three volumes, that I noticed there's a recurring series of chaotic periods in the sense of, if you think in terms of human progress, there's really tremendous stress on the human reproductive capacities of human systems. And actually there are, as we now in a sense argue, and as I've argued, that there are really three periods. One that started 2200 BC to 1700 BC, and that was the start of the first Dark Age, as I would call it. And it impacted only on a certain region in the world, because at that 5,000 years ago, at that point in time, there's only very few areas that were populated by humans and in terms of urbanization and all that. And so the three main areas that were really impacted that we have both archaeological information as well as temperature information on is that of the Fertile Crescent, which would be southern Mesopotamia, and then, of course, northwestern India of the Harappan civilization, and then some parts of China. By the 1200 BC period to the 700 BC period, you have tremendous spread, because as the civilizations and society continue to evolve, it's now much more of a global consequences, but not totally global, but mostly between Europe, Central Asia, and South Asia and China. Then, of course, we have the last one that we are familiar with, which would be the what we normally call the Dark Age of Antiquity. That's when the fall of the Roman Empire started, around about 300 AD to around about 900, whereby you see tremendous consequences. But one of the interesting things that we have to realize about Dark Ages are a series of characteristics that still recur in each Dark Age, right? First of all, as you know, we call it a Dark Age because from our knowledge of progress, you have economic slowdowns and trade disruptions. Then you have political unrest and breakdowns. One of the most interesting features of this Dark Ages is that you have reduced social stratification and social simplification of lifestyles. And I'll elaborate more on this later. Then you have deurbanization, you have increased migration, and you have population losses. All these elements of a socioeconomic and political nature tend to recur over the three Dark Ages. And on that basis, it gives us some ideas of what we can expect if there's a forthcoming Dark Age. The two books, or I mean the three books, I would say, starts to talk about how the implications of this type of trends have for human societies and the reproduction. But what's important that we should realize is that during Dark Ages, whereby it is quite, in terms of progress, retrogressive or devolutionary, but it's a good opportunity because if you have economic slowdowns and trade disruptions, therefore you have a less intensive utilization of natural resources, and the impact on the human, of the environment by humans are going to be less. So on that basis, from the point of nature, it is a really quite a important period because it allows nature to recover because of the slower economic slowdowns. And at the same time, it allows socioeconomic reconfiguration that are allowing for a next stage of social evolution.
We will get back to that. There's a lot more to talk about there. But right now, who do you think has a better chance of riding out a severe economic or ecological challenge, the rich developed world or less developed countries?
Well, it depends. Well, it is actually, if there is going to be a next Dark Age approaching, because of the interconnected nature of the regions of the world, you will definitely find tremendous catastrophic conditions all over the world. Because if you trace the previous three Dark Ages, the places that are interconnected economically, socially, and politically are the ones that are very impacted the most. And to get out of those Dark Age periods, there was economic expansion and political reconfiguration occur in terms of expansion to other parts of the world, whereby there have been less human populations and human development. So what is really interesting that we have to realize is that this is a continuous evolutionary process, and that we are now at a stage whereby there is really tremendous pressure, whereby very few areas of the world have not been, in a sense, inhabited or exploited by human civilizations for their own socioeconomic ends, other than perhaps the ocean. And even in the ocean, the few remaining areas are the Arctic and the Antarctic. And therefore, the question is, where is the next set of expansion going to come from that allows us to continue to use the natural resources that we need to survive? And therefore, when you look at the Dark Ages, then it becomes really interesting. First, during Dark Ages, as I mentioned before, you have reduced social stratification and social simplification of life, lifestyle, not because they choose to do that, but because they had to do that because of the lack of natural resources. So in certain ways, it forces society to, in a sense, think of new ways to develop new strategies to survive. And in that sense, that's where I believe you have social evolutionary progress.
Now, Dr. Chu, in your last book of your series, Ecological Futures, you don't promise any salvation for this global economy. What do you see happening?
I did try in certain ways because, as you know, the three volumes were written over a course of over a decade. And my attitude towards what's going to happen continues to evolve. But towards the end, I tried to talk about the potential of being able for Earth to evolve. And that evolve further in a sense of a long-term social evolutionary evolution process. What I try to suggest is that we should move to what I call a weightless economy. In other words, whereby we use less natural resources and we use it more intelligent-wise in that context, whereby we're already increasing seeing the potential of that, whereby we purchase what I call symbols that are not materialist material in nature, and we allow, therefore, a sort of a financial economic exchange to go on forth. In other words, like when, for example, you download a movie or a music video or a song from a website, you're not asking for anything more material from that purchase. You're just paying your monetary funds to get a weightless, or I call it weightless, whereby you're getting a set of images or noise that you see on your iPhone or your desktop or wherever it is. So in that sense, it allows us to continue to be able to meet certain social economic satisfaction without relying too much on the ability of the planet to produce the natural resources for us to continue to meet our, in fact, I think, very exploitative needs.
So cyberspace is the new frontier. I do get that, and people have been talking about that. We'll have to see whether the international internet can survive if we have a global downturn, an extreme one. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith, with our guest, Dr. Sing-Sea Chu, an expert in the long-term history and culture of our species. Well, let's take a detour from those heavy thoughts and look at a speech that you gave just at the end of this February in Singapore at the Conference on Sustainability and Education. You ask what university education is for. That's a good question. And then you answer, quote, "Higher education has largely been shaped by the drive to extend our human domination of the planet. Can we steer it into something different?"
You mean like, can we change higher education to something different?
Yes.
Yes. What I try to express in the first part of the keynote is that we have different types of knowledge that we do in the university or we produce in the university. There are basically three types. One, the natural scientific knowledge of the natural sciences. And then the other one, the social sciences, which is supposed to provide an understanding of our social world and therefore be able to help us emancipate human societies from some of the issues that it finds challenges to face. Then, of course, the humanities, whereby it's really its interest is in a way to promote the understanding or and prolongation of cultural experiences. Now, these three sciences have been, in a sense, played out in the generation of knowledge in the university. And of course, in our day and age, it continues to what I call a very anthropocentric approach, whereby we totally utilize the methodologies, the rationality, and so on and so forth of the natural sciences to determine our lives, both in social choices and in terms of social scientific choices, right? That type of mentality is important in some ways in order for us to have strategic successes into reproducing human societies on a material basis. But we cannot really use that type of knowledge for all aspects of our life. And that's where I suggested in the keynote that we really have to have a balance. We have to consider some of the critical social sciences of providing value judgments about what we should do and what we can do. And as well, the humanities provide certain moral ethos to be able to guide us, to let us consider what are the choices in terms of what the past can tell us and what the future can be. I sort of like to think of the past as a teacher of life in certain ways, whereby we let history become a way of guiding us of what has happened in the past in order for us to anticipate a probable livable future.
So what do you mean when you say sustainability is unsustainable?
This is really what we have been talking here in Northern California, in the sense that with the increase in terms of the world's population, with the continuous heightened accumulation of profits and the reinvestment of profits to generate more profits, and with the level of urbanization that is continuously going on, that in some ways, as you know, most urban places are very natural resource intensive and intensive in every other way. So what it means is that there is a continuous, if you want to call it, exponential need to maintain these urban communities, the level of population levels that are increasingly becoming unbearable in terms of the natural environment to sustain. And so why are we talking about sustainability? Because as far as we can really understand it, I'd rather talk about the unsustainability of sustainability, because sustainability has been a concept that has had so many meanings thrown at it, and it started way before the Pearson Commission, where there was that discussion in Canada about that, all the way now to the Brundtland Report, and we have had so many international meetings and organizations coming to address this issue, and so far there has been perhaps ecological awareness, but very little what I would call ecological consciousness. And perhaps in some places there might have been ecological consciousness leading to some social mobilization. But that has not been that successful. And so how are we going to make a sustainable world whereby this conflict over the accumulation of capital determining most of the choices that we make and the urbanization process that are continuously to spiral upwards? And then, of course, you have the deforestation process, which I have, in a sense, talked about in the earlier part of this discussion. But what is interesting about going back to the Dark Ages is that during Dark Ages, you have population losses that forces, therefore, a population drop and, therefore, less intensification utilization of natural resources. Like, I'll give an example. 1 century AD, the city of Rome had 1 million people. After the end of the Roman Empire, with the Dark Age of Antiquity, Rome was around about 40,000 people, right? That population level was never achieved again in Europe until the 18th century London, okay? So you can see these consequences of Dark Ages, whereby it does give us a sense to pause, or it forces us to learn, because I've argued in one of the closing remarks of one of the volumes that it is not the problem of learning. We always learn. Human societies are very ingenious. It is not learning which is the problem.
Well, you know, at the end of each period of civilization, you found institutions which seem to signal the oncoming Dark Age, even as they operate almost as lifeboats for future rebirth later on. Could you describe those for us?
Yeah, there are certain features that you really need to, in a sense, consider that these Dark Ages offer, rather than negative moments, but I would call positive moments in terms of the ability of human societies to come up with new solutions, right? If you have a drop in population, for example, there was a drop in population in one of the Dark Ages, and therefore it allows certain rejuvenation in terms of political processes. And in this case, the classical Greece, the period before the classical Greece period, you have the demise and the deurbanization process appearing in Mycenaean Greece. And what happened after that was the evolution and the appearance of the polis, or the first city-state. And that offered opportunity in terms of political development and political learning processes that therefore allow the further evolution of a political process moving away from empires which still predominated the whole social, political, economic landscape of the Mediterranean. But you have the emergence of this nascent political idea, which then the Romans took it to a different level, to a sort of republican form of political process. And that was really quite interesting, too, because it only lasted a few periods, because republican Rome was then taken by imperial Rome. So you have this now opportunities whereby we have the opportunity, or it is forced upon us because of our exploitative nature, to force us to rethink different ways. So right now, we do have opportunities in terms of ideas that we can rethink. I do have a scenario that what happens if there is a total collapse, a global collapse, if you want to call it that way. What will happen? Therefore, it will be utmost upon us to rethink what we are doing, and that maybe perhaps that at that point in time, all the basic knowledge that we have lost in the sense of how to farm and how to live within the landscape, or what we call living along the contours of the land, will really need to be retaught and, in a sense, reinvestigated, and then perhaps a new form of political process or political participation, and, of course, decision-making about our natural environment will force us to make changes.
Well, that's almost the bright side of the Dark Ages. But, you know, if you're a student who are studying to be a success in life now as we know it, that's a tough pill to swallow. What do your students make of this?
Yeah, some of my graduate students have gone on. One of my graduate students, well, I was very impressed that after he finished his degrees, he decided to become a farm manager for a 100-acre organic farm on the Columbia River. And that was quite a major effect. And I met him a couple of months ago, and he said that he is so invigorated that he wakes up every morning at 4 o'clock, because he starts his work, as you know, as a farmer, much earlier than what we normally wake up. And he can't wait to get to work. So there are new opportunities. If we are talking about a weightless economy in the internet and all that, there are those opportunities there. But the major concern that we have also is that what is going to be provide the sources of energy, right? And therefore, I have read somewhere that the amount of servers that are going to be powered and required to meet this type of internet age will be about the consumption level of 30% of the world's energy volume per year. So we do have to make choices. And the problem right now is that we really do not make choices. We are guided by our choices, by the urbanization process, by the consumption process, and so on and so forth. We could consider possibly, let's say, a diet or a menu that is here in Northern California. We like to talk about the 500-mile menu or the 50-mile menu. In other words, we do not eat any food materials that are beyond 500 miles. Whereas nowadays, we have a globalized agriculture. We have a globalized food exchange system. Therefore, we are drinking water imported from Fiji. We are buying food from Latin America in terms of farm consumption during certain seasons where we cannot have that. In other words, we can't have it all, and we have to make those decisions. And it's important for us to do that. If not, if my thesis seems to suggest, if not, then nature will make it for us. Or like we've seen here in Northern California, nature is the last one to bend.
Yes, nature can be in the driver's seat if we just take it too far. And it's interesting to think that, as you've talked about, deurbanization, bioregionalism, community-supported agriculture, these are things that are beginning movements now. Maybe those are our preparation for the coming fall. Your program at Helmholtz about shrinking the economy, that's another really interesting story.
Yes, that's a very important issue that we all need to consider.
Yeah.
The project has ended, but the shrinkage is something that we really, really have to deal with. It's already ongoing, and there's enough indication that by the United Nations Population Fund that we're anticipating the urbanization to end around about 2070. And that's in some ways dovetail with the peak oil issue.
Yeah.
And so all those will have to come to a head. And in other words, I hope that the changes are made consciously by us and not for us.
I agree. And I'm thinking, too, you know, Staples is closing many, many stores because they say everybody's shopping online. So we're starting to take that other direction that you talked about as well.
Yeah, because of the physical space that is not going to be occupied. But then the problem I always talked about is that we have already, in a sense, excavated the whole earth. And so, you know, I wish there was something left, right? So, you know, we didn't talk about terraforming.
No.
And this is now, or else why do you think the International Space Station is being pushed so hard? The Chinese are putting one up, right? And that NASA, I think in the 80s, projected that you can have 50,000 two-member families on the moon, right? And that's that big push to go to Mars.
Wow.
And the Mars is where the action is, because it's a livable, well, it's not a livable planet without a high level of technology, but it's another way, right? We do hear talk about the issue of, you know, after you wreck one planet, why not try another one?
It's been great talking with you. Perhaps we'll talk again. Yeah.
How did you hear of my work?
I started with Nicole Foss, and then I got to David Korowitz. And I think David Korowitz referenced your work. And then I started looking into it and went, well, this is good stuff.
Yeah, because mostly in Europe, they discover the work because I spent some time in Europe. Well, I mean, I have an appointment in Germany, and that also helps.
Yes, it does. I have to wrap it up there and say Dr. Sing C. Chu, and that's spelled C-H-E-W. He's a professor of sociology at Humboldt State University in California and a senior research scientist at the Helmholtz Center for Environmental Research in Leipzig, Germany. And there's things we should talk about there another time. He's introduced nature back into history, and Dr. Chu lectures around the world about past civilizations and dark ages and their message for us now. Dr. Chu, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be able to do this.
I enjoyed it. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.